Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. And now, here's Ellen.
Thanks. Well, I have a blazing cold today, but I'm going to push on through. The inimitable George Carlin said, "It's all a big game, and we're not in it. They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it." And that does seem to be where most Americans still are today. But there are hopeful signs that some people are waking up, and we saw that particularly at our last two public banking symposia. One was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, several weeks ago, and the other was last Saturday in Philadelphia. There was this sort of grassroots democratic fervor that was quite hopeful and inspiring at both of these conferences, which are going to be the subject of our show today. We got a big wake-up call last year with Thomas Piketty's bombshell book, Capital in the 21st Century. It went to number one on Amazon, which was pretty amazing considering that it's an economics text. It's 700 pages long, and it's a translation from the French. But what was startling, what was eye-opening about the book was that he was able to explode the myths of capitalism using statistics, which are pretty much irrefutable. He showed that greed is not good, markets do not self-correct if left to themselves, a rising tide does not lift all boats. In fact, the boat it particularly lifts is that of the 0.01%, which has shot to exponential heights at the expense, particularly, of the lower 95%, whose incomes since 2008 on average have actually shrunk. So this system is not only not fair, it's not sustainable. The 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, which was supposed to fix the problems of causing the 2008 crash, has not fixed them. It's full of loopholes, and as fast as it manages or to block one of these loopholes, the financial engineers, the whoever it is who devise these financial products, are able to come up with other financial products that get around the rules. So it's really not possible to regulate the current system into something that's fair and sustainable. We really need to overhaul the system, and we think the way to do it is with a public banking model. 97% of our circulating money supply is now created by banks when they make loans. That is a function that we need to recapture, we the people, and we can do it by having our own banks. The Philadelphia Symposium was held in the Quaker Friends Center, which was a quite auspicious location because the Quakers actually developed the first and what I would consider the best of the public banking models in the United States before it even was the United States, back in Benjamin Franklin's day. I've written about that at length in Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution and in various articles, so I won't go into it now. But what we did on Saturday was to re-examine that model today in the light of today's issues and see how we might apply it and actually put our money and banking system back into the hands of the people. We were very pleased to see a number of local elected officials attending both events. In Santa Fe, Javier Gonzalez, who is the newly elected mayor, is actually pushing for a public bank and was one of the featured speakers. The first thing elected officials want to know, generally, is where are they going to find the money to capitalize a bank? They will typically say, we don't have money sitting around. We need our money for our budgets. And all state and local budgets are in pretty desperate straits at the moment. So that was something I addressed in my PowerPoint. We would argue they actually do have the money. They have it sitting around in rainy day funds and surplus funds, which, although they can't be spent, they could be invested and they could be invested at a much better return than they're getting now. For example, in California, which is my state, the California Treasurer has an investment pool currently containing $54 billion, earning 0.23% interest, almost nothing. So you could take just a small portion of that and use that for your capital for a bank and pay, let's say you paid 3% interest on it, then that capital is enough to back 10 times, or actually 9 times after you take out the reserve requirement, 9 times that sum in loans. So let's say you were paying 3% on your capital and you get 9 times 3% on your loans, or better yet, use it to buy municipal bonds where you don't even have to go out and solicit customers and worry about credit worthiness and so forth. So you're getting 9 times 3% and you're paying 1 time 3%, so you're getting 8 times 3% in profit. And your costs aren't high at all for a public bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota. There's no advertising. You don't have to go out and solicit customers. You don't have to solicit borrowers. You don't have to solicit depositors. They don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. They don't have any high-paid CEOs. And they don't have to compete with the other banks. They're actually partnering with the other banks. And they have the backing of the government. You wouldn't even have to have a building. You wouldn't have to have tellers, because if you do the Bank of North Dakota model, you're actually just taking the government's revenues. That is your depositor, so you don't have to deal with the banking accounts of a lot of individuals. So it's a very efficient way to run a bank. Basically, you are your own banker, which means you get to save, for example, 50% on the cost of infrastructure, since interest makes up about 50% of the cost of infrastructure, and if you own the bank, you get the interest back. So anyway, I explain my thoughts on that in my PowerPoint, which I'm posting on my blog at ellenbrown.com, and it was also the subject of my last article titled Building an Ark: How to Protect Public Revenues from the Next Meltdown, which is also posted on my blog at ellenbrown.com. So the bottom line is that when the people own the bank and the bank is dedicated to financing the needs of the community, we can recapture the American dream by freeing ourselves from debt slavery to large corporations. That is the heart of the public banking movement, restoring our rights to an economy that is built not on greed, but on service and sustainability. And that's the theme we'll be exploring with today's guests, Craig Barnes and Mike Krause, who speak with my co-host, Walt McCrae. Take it away, Walt.
Thanks, Ellen. Today we're going to talk about some of the underlying dynamics that push the concept of public banking forward at a time of great need, when citizens the world over are deprived of their best opportunities to live full and creative lives because they're preoccupied with the need to pay their debts from borrowing money. The public bank prospect offers a new future, one in which money is provided on a different basis, one of utility rather than money as a commodity to achieve and acquire. Our guest today is a remarkable citizen, the author of Democracy at the Crossroads, commentator and international negotiator, a man for all seasons, whose knowledge and heart has brought a whole new prospect for economic fairness to his home city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He is Craig Barnes, a classic American spirit, a man of circumspect knowledge and indefatigable courage. Here is how Craig opens his introductory post on the website for the Banking on New Mexico conference, raising the theme that we'll be discussing today as we report on the importance of pursuing public banks now. Here's his introductory remark, entitled Responding to the Rise of Plutocracy and the Role International Banks Play in It. He says, "Historically, democracies spread responsibility, creativity, human dignity, and as a result, general prosperity. But they do so well after a time that great wealth is achieved, and then, unfortunately, success produces a dangerous counterforce. Elites begin to channel the wealth more and more to themselves, and inequality increases, gradually spreading to the crippling disadvantage of the middle class and the poor. Now, with the powers of ancient aristocrats, these elites begin to blame this disadvantage on the takers, closing the doors of opportunity to everyone but themselves. At that point, the very institutions of democracy begin to unravel. That is the situation in the world today, and is especially true in the United States, where the government is more representative of billionaires than anyone else. Those are the comments of Craig Barnes, our guest today, to whom I asked the question about the process of how to free ourselves from oligarchic control of resources, something that goes back 800 years to the days of feudalism when the Magna Carta was signed in the year 1215. The Magna Carta extracted certain rights for the people, and it was the basis on which our Western law and rights were founded, including our American Bill of Rights. Craig reflects on that historical dynamic.
The origins of this, there are two themes that run through Western history, and especially through English parliamentary history, that lay behind us, but provide the ground from which this current effort springs. Two themes. One does begin with the Magna Carta, and that is the insistence by the barons, some 20 or so barons who had a lot of troops out in the field, that they no longer would be taxed without being participants in councils in which they were asked, and also to which they were summoned after notification of what the issues would be. So if the king said, come to this council, they were saying, you got to tell us what tax you want to raise and let us get prepared in advance. This becomes, in effect, the ground from which due process springs, that you have to have notice of meetings, notice of the content of meetings. All of that runs all the way forward to this current day, due process, which doesn't exist in bank decisions, in banking boardroom decisions. There's no due process for citizens there. So it's a theme which has run down through government circles and legal circles, but hasn't helped us much in the banking area. And what happened, what the banking area has run in a separate stream, really beginning with Henry I in about 1100, or about a little more than 100 years before the Magna Carta, when Henry I got so sick of the moneylenders charging him interest on the money he paid to his soldiers, or he borrowed to pay to his soldiers, he said, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to issue, and then we all know, Ellen Brown has instructed this, and I think it's great information. I love it. The king issued these sticks into which he carved notches indicating how much they were worth, 1 pound stick with one notch, 2 pound stick, two notches, and ripped the stick lengthwise in half and used that one half to pay the soldiers. And the soldiers could use that stick with the notches on it to pay for bread, and the bread seller could use it to pay his taxes. So the king completely ran an end run around the moneylenders, the goldsmiths, by issuing his own money in the form of sticks and getting paid back with the taxes in the form of sticks. So the king avoided all that interest that he had to pay the moneylenders. It was a great thing. It went on for 400 or 500 years. I think it was not abolished until about the 19th century, when it was formally abolished, but they actually used it for hundreds of years. That struggle that begins in 1100 with Henry I runs down through time until today, when we are still saying, how did money get created, and why is all the debt creation, all the money come, why is it created with debt? Why do we not only borrow $1,000 in principal, but have to pay $1,100 back? Why the 100? Who's going to get that? Where's that going to come from? And that, sudden awakening now, and once again in the 21st century, wait a minute, why are we paying interest on all the things that we have to do? They are public purposes. Why should the public pay a private bank interest for building a health center or building a school center or building a football field? Why should the public pay the private banks to create the money when they can create it just like Henry I did 800 years, 900 years ago? So actually 1,000 years ago. So that conversation has resurfaced. To my great surprise, thanks to Ellen Brown and other writers, we've discovered here that this understanding that the banks have the capacity to run countries ragged and drain them dry doesn't just start with us. It starts with Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln and William Garfield and Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy. Presidents faced with financing problems over the 200-plus years of our history have come up against the realization that, my God, the money we get, we pay back with interest. Why is that the case? So it's a current theme that is actually a contest, as it has been for now 900 years, 1,000 years, a contest between the democratic or the legitimate government authority and the money lenders or the bankers. And the banker's interest is not in democracy. It's not in maintaining the opportunities for people to go into business and spread prosperity. The banking interest is different. It's to accumulate their own profits, and they are now in a position, as in 2014, to strangle, suffocate democracy. And so we have an odd, bizarre system in which the money lenders from the Middle Ages forward have tried to get strangleholds on kings and presidents, and have now substantially got that stranglehold on the U.S. Congress. So it is a long-term fight, and it has been won from time to time. There have been successes against it, so we're not losing all the time. But when democracy is under siege like it is now, we have to find anew ways to create democracy in our financing here locally, and therefore the consideration of a public bank.
It seems that the stranglehold, as you put it, really is, the windows are closing. You know, the noose is getting tighter. I don't know what kind of so many other metaphors we could use that have to do with desperation and disappointment, I think, too, that money and the control of money becomes the nexus at which the democracy is able to actually have promise. And the public bank response would seem to be maybe one of the only strategic plays that we have left. What's your thought about that kind of a claim?
Well, I think there are 100 organizations working on campaign finance reform and media reform, and they are all essential to carry forward in order to retrieve democracy from this stranglehold. But the most practical and easiest to get our mind around way is to create our own banking system which responds to our needs rather than the needs of, say, the Bank of International Settlements establishing capitalization requirements in Basel, Switzerland. Rather than having our capital requirements established in a distant city in a distant country and our priorities established there, we ought to be able to establish them locally. So public banking does give us a chance to reinvigorate democracy and spend the returns from banking on the democratically chosen projects, such as early childhood education and utility, maybe purchasing utilities and things like that. All of that can be decided with a democratic system, which we currently don't have, and which is currently being squeezed out by these big banks.
Do you observe that there's a significant consolidation of power in the monetary and the financial world of late? Has this trend, it seems, in the last 20 or 30 years has really put the squeeze on everybody around the world. What is, in your view, what's it going to take to really get a practical and a decent sort of an opportunity back for democratic power?
Well, I think one of the great mistakes is to think that the changes in American history or global history, but let's just take American history, have originated in Washington, D.C., or in the powers of the Supreme Court of the United States. The major cultural changes, the reforms, have begun outside of the capital city, outside of the capital financial capitals like Wall Street and Chicago. These reforms in American history have begun in small towns that we've hardly ever heard of, so that the mining reform, the labor reform, begins in desperate miners in the mountains of Colorado and the wheat fields of for populism, the wheat fields of Nebraska. These, the towns like Seneca Falls, New York, whoever heard of Seneca Falls, New York, but it ushers in 1848, it ushers in a whole new conversation and finally a cultural change about women. Whoever heard of Trinidad, Colorado, where the miners got their start? Whoever heard of the small cities in Vermont where the anti-nuclear freeze movement got started? Eventually, these movements changed the country, changed the focus of the country, direction of the country. So that I think when we say, well, we're only having a public bank, or might be tempted to say, we're only going to have a public bank in Pittsburgh, or you're only going to have it in Philadelphia or Santa Fe. What can you do from Santa Fe? What can you start? Well, anybody who looks at American history will see that all of the great movements started in small towns like Santa Fe or like Burlington, Vermont, or places around the country, so that we ought not be discouraged. We ought to realize this is the way change begins. It doesn't begin by taking on the trillions of dollars of assets that Wells Fargo has or J.P. Morgan Chase has at the top. It begins by finding alternative solutions where we are that we can actually control, which means public banking could be the lever that changes the world.
That's a really good observation. I always appreciate hearing a hopeful note about the power of individuals. As one of our other show guests, Kevin Zeese, pointed out, that if you get 3.5% of your populace to go with you on an issue, you will win. So it's not everybody that has to get the message. It is merely a core group of individuals who are willing to lead a path. And of course, that's true for our own revolution. It basically started in a bar, you know. If we could take a look, kind of moving ahead to this week's development in Scotland, and I realize that by the time this airs, Scotland will have decided one way or the other. But the issue for independence there raised a possibility for them to take control of their own money by perhaps separating from the Bank of England and so forth. Do you have any sense of whether or not that kind of movement for independence has got further legs around the world? If any predictions you might want to make about what kind of momentum might get created there?
Well, there are two competing streams in global existence right now. One is the consolidation of money that is being forwarded by money and power, being forwarded by the great corporations, and the concentration of money that they have leads us in one direction toward consolidation across Europe and across the globe of banking combines and banking standards on the one hand, and on the other hand, a pretty substantial reaction against that in interest groups and ethnic groups and all around the world, so that the one way of looking at the Middle East and the strong resistance to Western culture is they're saying, just as the Scottish are saying, we want to do this ourselves. We want to take charge of our own lives, and we don't like the values that the great banks represent. We don't like the secrecy that the great corporations within which they meet in order to decide whether to mine our copper or mine our gold or clog up our rivers. We don't like the loss of personal control or dignity that comes with a global corporate takeover. So these two streams are in conflict, and I think that the Scottish vote for independence, however it turns out, and the Middle Eastern cries of individuals saying, we don't want your materialism, are rooted in the same sense that we don't have governments now that represent us so much as they are taken over by and become financing machines for the great banks, the great corporations. So this separatist movement is not going to go away, and it responds in immediate proportion to the lack of democracy. The worse the democratic processes, the more the Scottish feel out of touch with Westminster, and that Westminster is not going to represent them, the more they're going to want to be independent. Democracy fails them in their mind. Well, that's the same democracy for the Middle East. They're saying, you got to be kidding. Democracy just doesn't belong here. It's a chaotic, material, self-interested way of dealing, and we don't want it. Well, that conversation is going on all over the world, and we're simply watching the chaos that comes with it.
We're making reference to some political isolationism, if you will, or separation, but we're really seeing that front and center economically in the U.S. as people are increasingly excluded from the promise and the protection of an economic system. People are looking for alternatives to their unwilling attachment to the corporate machine. So that it seems like local economies then are on the front line of a replacement vehicle. Would you agree with that sort of a notion that, you know, the alternative would be of local creation and perhaps not look anything like it, but it has?
Well, yes, I think that's right. I think what we are all forced to deal with now for the first time in many of our lifetimes, and probably most of us, we're forced to deal with a capitalistic system which has become unresponsive to the majority of populations within which it's seated. So we are coming to grips with financing as the core engine of that capitalistic system, as the central provider of money in that system, money without which it can't function. We are coming to grips with that flaw in a way that I think hasn't happened since before the Second World War, and not in a major way since the 19th century. The response to Marx's socialism has been so virulent and so angry and so fearful that kind of conversation has been off limits for people for 100 years. And I think we're coming back into that time when we can ask the question without fear of Joseph McCarthy coming after us. We can ask the question, what in the world is this system doing which guarantees profits for the very wealthiest and continues to squeeze the last dollar out of the middle class and the poor? What is this? Why isn't this system responsive to democracy? And I think we're having that conversation now in a serious way for the first time in my lifetime, mm-hmm. which is really good.
Yeah. Do you think that alternative currencies are also in that mix as likely developments?
They apparently are being developed all over the world. And Gwendolyn Hallsmith, who is now the executive director of the Public Banking Institute, has written a wonderful book, Creating Wealth, explaining those alternative currencies being experimented with and being used officially in places all around the world. I think that when people are desperate and can't play in the big bank game, they're going to find ways to trade between themselves. And that's always going to happen. And if they create currencies between themselves that facilitate that trade, that will be, it doesn't have to be sponsored by any one of us or any central organization. People are going to come up with that and have been coming up with that all through time as a way to do the deals they need to do without waiting for Wall Street to say, yeah.
Among the many remarkable things you've done in your career, Craig, I happen to notice that you were on the diplomatic team that helped to negotiate, I believe, water rights or water marketing between Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and there's another one in there.
Kazakhstan.
You know, when you look at bringing such diverse communities together as would be required by an alternative economic system, how do you approach marrying those interests? And how might that reflect as a model for how we could go forward in designing an alternative to our dependence on big banks and corporate control?
I think that's a huge point. I think it's critical, and it may not be sufficiently discussed. I think you're onto something. The tally sticks that Henry I circulated wouldn't have worked if the people hadn't trusted that he would accept them back to pay his taxes. So the trust was absolutely essential. They trusted that king and then subsequent kings to use them in the right way. And it is true for, certainly true for alternative currencies that are just emerging. You have to trust that they will be honored and that the system has integrity. And I think that the foundation of that is in at least two components or two thought streams. One is, how does this work technically? Can we trust that this dollar is worth a dollar worth of bread, or this greenback, if we call it by a different name and we make it ourselves? How do we trust that the baker will give me one greenback's worth of bread in return for that? Requires at the beginning, people knowing each other, requires them understanding that they are part of a common social experiment. And the experiment can go out to strangers, but it starts with people who have some trust. I think that's huge. And then the other part of it is the competition. We may not approve of Wells Fargo, but we don't think they have built what they've built on fraud and corruption at every step, that they're more likely to be trustworthy on the whole than people we don't know starting an alternative currency across town. So I think the competition of that second existing system makes the entrance by any community into an alternative money system have to be slow and brought forward by people who have integrity and are really trusted.
That's very good commentary. The thing about democracy is that it is really, we're making it up as we go along. We do rely on the goodwill of others, hopefully the common sense, and of course the hard work that helps to make a community thrive.
One of the things that before you move on, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but one of the things that is terribly impressive, both in the 18th century prior to the formation of the American First Declaration and then the Constitution, and still through the 19th century and into the early 20th century, is an attempt in the conversation originating out of Scotland, really, first, an attempt to discover the public good and to serve the public good, to serve something larger than self-interest. So precedent to the rise of corporations is this long-term, centuries-long conversation about how do we do good for the public? How do we serve the community? That's still going on, as we hear in this series on the Roosevelts, absolutely furious effort that Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor made to serve the public. That desire to serve the public has been ridiculed in the last 30 years. It's been demeaned as if the market can serve the public, but communitarian goals or goals to take care of those least able to take care of themselves, those efforts have been demeaned in the last 30 years. And before we will get a public currency, and probably before we get public banking in any community, we have to revive our confidence that that's the right thing to do. That it is right and proper to be trying to serve the public interest rather than selfish, narrow interest. That ethical sense, and you've pointed to it a couple of times in our conversation, that value sense has to be led by people like yourselves in the public banking effort and people who are not chained to I think now chained to Washington.
Well, that is well said. Thank you for all of this, Craig. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to continuing this work together in bringing about the next phase of our democratic revolution, as it were.
Great to talk to you, Walt.
Thank you so much, Craig.
All right.
That's Craig Barnes. Our conversation was recorded back in September, just prior to the Santa Fe Banking on New Mexico Symposium, of which he was the principal founder. Before moving on to a related conversation with Mike Krause from the Pennsylvania Project, in which we'll talk about the just-completed Philadelphia Conference, we want to conclude this discussion with Craig with the last 2 minutes of his address to the plenary group, which offered a word of hope and confidence about the ability of individuals and communities who are intent on making a systemic change toward a fairer economy.
And do not ever think that we are too small. Do not think we are just Santa Fe, or just Bernalillo, or just New Mexico. In 1848, the women's movement burst onto the national scene from the small town of Seneca Falls, New York. Who had ever heard of Seneca Falls? In the 1870s, the miners' movement, and later the labor movement, exploded from the hills and small states of West Virginia and Colorado. Who ever expected reform to come from the miners' families huddled in the cold snows outside Ludlow, Colorado? Who ever heard of Ludlow, Colorado? In the 1960s, the civil rights movement burst into the national consciousness from the tiny community of Selma, Alabama. In the 1980s, the consciousness of the possible consequences of nuclear war first emerged from the tiny town meetings in Vermont. Now we precious few, are gathered again to advance a new idea that will give a practical response to our damaged hopes and our dreams. The road before us is long, but like those who have gone before and on behalf of those yet to come, we will keep everlastingly at it. And who knows, maybe the Hopis were right. Maybe now in the 21st century, we are the people we have been waiting for. Thank you for coming.
I'm here with Mike Krause, who is one of the founding members of the Public Banking Institute, currently a member of the board, and the founder of the Pennsylvania Project, which is the state-focused and regional-focused initiative to get public banks underway in the Mid-Atlantic area, focusing on Pennsylvania, where there's been lots of activity, and in which we recently, just this past weekend, completed a really exciting conference. Mike, welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.
Well, good to be here.
We just listened to some interviews with Craig Barnes and Ellen talking about the backdrop or the context in which the public banking initiative is taking place. I think before we get into looking at how the Pennsylvania Conference played out and what the topics were that we discussed then, I wanted to just touch on the real nature of this struggle, as it were. It seems that people are once again, hopefully, moving toward the trenches to try to protect themselves against an increasing influence and control of our resources, our money resources, all kinds of resources. What do you see on that frontier? Is there anything hopeful that you see?
Well, I think so. I think people are reacting to 40 years of the gospel of privatization. We've been told the private sector does everything better. Well, that's not necessarily true. What it is doing is grabbing up public resources, which then leases back to us. One example, of course, is water systems, public gas systems. Being starved for resources, we're told they just can't function well. We need investment, and we're broke, so we better sell them off. You can say that's the same thing happening with the public education. Starved of resources so that charter schools can move in, take your school buildings, which they don't have to build, pay teachers low salaries, turn them over several times, drive your costs down, and make money teaching kids how to take tests.
Rick Wolf points out that there is no evidence that privatization makes things more efficient.
It doesn't, it doesn't. Some things, obviously, the private sector does well, making cars, for example. Some things it doesn't do well, like your retirement. Social Security is one of the best-run retirement programs in the world. It's solvent. It puts in more money than goes out. The banks want to privatize your retirement. Well, why? Well, because Social Security takes today $1 trillion a year, and the banks want their hands on that so they can put it in their coffers to gamble with in derivatives and things like that. It simply will not make your retirement safer or more efficient. In fact, Social Security has got to be one of the best-run administrations on the planet. At a 3% administrative overhead, what private pension fund can match that? Yet there are many hopeful signs as people are waking up to what's actually going on, which is the privatization of everything.
With the infrastructure of the country, you know, the very important public assets that we have that make everything possible, we've already seen a good bit of deterioration in the quality of their services. It sounds like they're even gearing up for a more accelerated financing foray into that field?
Well, the Department of Transportation and Treasury, a couple days ago, had what was called a privatization party. Treasury represents Wall Street. What are they doing there? Well, they're looking for ways to privatize roads, bridges, parking spaces, as have happened in California and Chicago and elsewhere, so that you pay for what used to be yours. You almost get the impression that they're glad to drive infrastructure into ruin so that they can say, well, you haven't got the money, but we do. Look how we can help you. That's a grab for public assets. It's what happened, for example, in Harrisburg. They drove the city into bankruptcy, and they picked up at pennies on the dollar their parking authority and their trash incinerator, which now they lease back at higher rate. It happens all over the country. It's a scam.
Elsewhere in Pennsylvania, there's this Act 47, where cities that are on the brink of bankruptcy suddenly have to live within an economic model that's operated by the state itself. That seems to also be a way of transferring or moving control into private hands.
It begins to look like legislatures are being lobbied to drive our cities into bankruptcy so that the privatization vultures can swoop in, pick up your gas systems, your water systems, your parking garages, your parks, your everything for that matter, at pennies on the dollar, and then lease you the privilege of being there.
So who's behind this dramatic acceleration of acquisition of public assets?
Well, I think it's a community of the largest banks and the banksters who understand where there is money to be made and how to get it. They've been very adept at getting money out of the American people, out of the Congress, $800 billion, out of the Federal Reserve, $20-some trillion of low-cost credit, so they can send you credit cards at 18, 19, 20%, back payday lending. It looks like a cabal of predators out there. And I'm not big into conspiracy theories. They kind of make your head hurt. But it's not a conspiracy to think that like-minded people act in like-minded ways. And clearly what Wall Street has discovered is there's a lot of money in the American people, and they want it.
As Ellen referenced in the Piketty book, this seems to be the natural cycle of capital seeking more for itself at the expense of public interest.
Well, unfortunately, the banking industry really no longer participates in what we call the real economy. They're not making loans to businesses. If they're making loans, they're making the hedge funds. They're in the world of paper deals and paper money. And they need resources, assets, deposits to back those huge gambles they have in derivatives, for example. It is reported that the five biggest banks now have a collective $200 trillion of derivatives. That has to be backed somewhere, somehow. So the grab is to get every bit of cash they can out of the American people on their balance sheets to cover those bets.
Well, when you look at the Postal Service as well, that's also one of the targets, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's said the Postal Service is broke. Well, no, it's not. They simply made them account for 75 years, I think it's 75 years, of retirement payments on their books today, like it all was going to be paid out today. Well, if you load up, all your future mortgage payments on your current household budget, you're broke. But no one does that. They're paid over time. So this was clearly a move to make the Post Office seem to be broke so we could argue, well, we've got to privatize it, of course.
And then, of course, the financial managers or designers, as I think Ellen said, and the big banks are looking to diminish the role and even the existence of community banks. And community banks are one of the last bastions of community monetary control.
Yeah, the facts are that, before 2000, let's go back about a decade, there were about 10,000 community banks. On the eve of the crash, there were 7,200. Now they're down to 5,400. The real effect of Dodd-Frank was to make it very expensive for community banks to comply with the new regulations. If you load up J.P. Morgan with, $5 million of compliance costs, that's no big deal. But if a local bank has to hire two people, let's say at $100,000 apiece, to do their compliance, that is a big deal. And that's forcing them out of business and consolidating. And that's what the largest banks want. They want ever larger market share so that they completely dominate U.S. banking.
And so a metaphor could be, or an analogy could be made, between the consolidation of power into the hands of a relative few to what we were talking about with Craig, about the oligarchic control of the really a neo-feudalist kind of society where people are debt slaves to a handful of special interests.
My degree was in government some time ago, and here's Government 101. Political power flows from wealth. And when wealth is concentrated, so too is political power. we have now the greatest concentration of the greatest wealth the world's ever seen in the fewest hands the world's ever seen. And along with that, so too has political power been concentrated in those same hands. That's why public banking, expecting relief from Washington, is simply a fool's errand. It's not coming. It doesn't matter who the next president is. There's no will in Washington to contend with the big banks. They're dug in. You can't take them head on. Well, what do you do with an enemy, and I say enemy, that's really dug in? You don't go up the center. You flank them. So any general or football coach looking at the position of the banks in Washington would say, geez, a frontal assault's crazy. I'm a football coach. Let's run an end run. I'm a general. Let's flank them.
So part of the strategy then for us is to try to protect the assets that we've got, like community banks and credit unions that are working locally as partners for what public banks can do in investing in local communities.
Well, yeah, the strategy is to form as many local, municipal, city, county, or state public banks as possible, bind them into a network. And in those public banks, we can do a couple of things. One, we can place our own deposits there, our municipal deposits there, safe away from the gamblers on Wall Street. Secondly, those banks then will operate in the real economy of your city, putting real money into real businesses, into education, into infrastructure, into neighborhood revitalization, into jobs creation. So what you get with a public bank is a financing mechanism for local initiative. So they have local control of locally met needs. That's really taps the diversity of this country. You know, I travel a lot, and I see of the United States, it's possibly most, its greatest characteristic is phenomenal diversity. England's a diverse country, but it's 36 million. We're 300 million diverse people with lots of opportunities, ideas, needs, possibilities. We want to enable those, and we think that a network of public banks will enable the innate strength, which is the diversity of the American people.
Well, we've just come off a really inspiring conference this past weekend where we talked to a lot of the stakeholders from cities all around the region. And one of them was an official from the city of Reading, where we've done some work in looking at what they're going to be doing with their money as a down and out, quote unquote, economic city. There's a lot of creativity going on there, and yet there's also they're up against the desire of others to dismantle or take apart their various assets.
Yeah, it really is an assault on the Commonwealth. We, the American people, collectively, in our city governments, state governments, hold some trillions of dollars of investments. Almost none of that is invested in our own communities. What Reading is looking for, what Pittsburgh is looking for, what Allentown is looking for, what Philadelphia is looking for, is a way to put their investments to work in their own community. So that instead of holding, you know, as Philadelphia does, possibly $11 billion of investments, none of that invests in the city. Instead, it's in financial products spread all around the world, doing absolutely no good whatsoever for the people of Philadelphia, whose money it is. So we're looking to find ways to put some of that money into the creation of public banks, some portion of those investments. We think the returns will be better, and there'll be other benefits, for example, job creation, for example, neighborhood revitalization, for example, a place to put your own municipal deposits so that they are not at risk on Wall Street.
The keynote speaker for the conference last weekend was Harold Meyerson from the Washington Post and an editor for the American Prospect, who's spent a lot of time around the country looking at various new city initiatives. Is that one of the bright spots, as you see?
It absolutely is. As I was saying earlier, you know, waiting for the Congress administration, this one or the next one, to do something can wait a long, very long time. I look at Wall Street and Washington as the axis of inaction. And that's a policy, by the way. When you don't do new things, you keep things the way they are. How are things? Well, money keeps flowing up more and more into fewer and fewer hands. That's how things are. What Harold observed, and it was exciting, are the initiatives of cities all across the nation to take matters into their own hands and try some new things. That's exciting. I think actually mayors will be leading the charge for the recovery of American prosperity.
Yeah, and some of the cities that were on his list include...
He included Seattle, Tacoma, San Francisco, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Pittsburgh, and others, where
Boston.
Mayors are stepping up. Boston's another one, a good example, where mayors are, New York, of course, with de Blasio, where mayors are trying new things. Well, you know, new things have to be tried. But cities are more agile than state legislatures or congresses. You know, you don't need 300 votes to get something done. It's not easy necessarily, but a mayor and a city council working together can move dramatically to implement change in their own communities.
Also, on the stage last weekend were representatives from a variety of stakeholder interests and official interests of the city of Philadelphia, in the city of Philadelphia, sustainable business, co-ops, Department of Commerce.
Green jobs.
So all of these possibilities are seem to be out there and newly excited about a possibility of having some new resources.
There are so many things that need to be done and that can be done, and there are good ideas out there. But there has to be some money. It's not going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from our state capitals, usually. It can come from within these cities themselves, using their resources to capitalize a public bank, partnering with local banks to get credit flowing to students, to businesses, to families, and into infrastructure and neighborhood revitalization. These are big ideas. All sorts of things are possible. There are lots of good ideas out there, but there has to be some source of funding. And in the modern economy, credit is the lifeblood of economic development. We don't pay cash. It's just not done. You can't do it. You can't build a new high school on cash. You've got to have affordable credit. You can't fund, aging gas works with cash. You've got to have affordable credit. What public banking can do is begin to drive affordable credit into those kinds of activities, which improve communities, improve the lives of residents, and offer some hope for families to build some prosperity of their own.
And also on the schedule last week, we had a presentation from Lenore Palladino at Demos talking about the impact of the student debts on families.
Well, most people are aware that we have burdened this generation of students with phenomenal debt that has to be paid off and will impact on their lives for decades. It makes it harder to start a family, to buy a home. It really is a huge burden. This is interesting. At the conference, there was a mother and her son from Pittsburgh, and she's married to a German. He's getting to be college age. They're moving back to Germany. Instead of spending, $35,000 at some Pennsylvania school, that young man will go to school for free. I'll say that again, for free in Germany. Now, we did that here. It's called the GI Bill. We not only sent GIs back to school, we gave them a stipend to live on. And every economist will tell you that produced benefits 7 times over for the American economy. It just helped the American economy take off after the Second World War.
Ellen Brown was saying in her presentation that when she went to school at Berkeley, it was free to begin with, University of California. And then when she went to law school at Berkeley, she spent $600 a year as an in-state student.
And now it's close to $55,000 a year. It's just insane. Our young people are our future. Why we don't invest in them is a scandal. Instead, we burden them. We shackle them with debt. It's a scandal. And it's just plain dumb.
Well, when we got down into the nitty-gritty of looking at how to make a bank, we had a couple of bankers on stage, and we talked about some of the complexities. Our listeners here, many of whom are involved in creating public banks, need to know that there are some cautious steps, there are some hurdles, there are some real challenges to this. How would you...
The process goes into 3 parts. The first is you've got to build political will. People have to know there's a problem. Well, we kind of know there's a problem. They have to understand how public banking can address that problem. We're coming around to that. That's step one in any community. Step two, then, is to look at the feasibility. Exactly how much money, from where, what's the specific mission of your public bank? Generally, we know what they do. Get affordable credit flowing, create non-tax revenue, partner with banks. That's the general stuff. But specifically, what do you want to do? Philadelphia, do you want to target 40,000 vacant properties? Do you want to put the profits into the schools? You've got to define mission. When you get past that, you've got to look at governance. And how do you make sure it's a bank run by bankers and not by politicians? Most Pennsylvanians will know what I mean when I say that. Actually, probably most Americans know what I'm talking about there. Then you get to the final step. To get a bank, you've got to get a bank charter from either the feds or the state banking authorities. Most likely the state banking authorities. They're not looking at banks with 6,000, 10,000, 12,000 subsidiaries. They're given a close look to good old-fashioned banks. They're well-regulated. It's a good department. They regulate our banks well in Pennsylvania. You need a charter. To get that, you've got to have a business plan. You need bankers to write that business plan. There's some... I've written business plans for businesses, but never for a bank. There's some esoteric stuff there. You need policies to manage risk, capital, credit, deposits, all sorts of things that don't occur in the normal commercial world of businesses. Banking is a special subject, actually. So it will need to be advised by bankers at that point. And I'm pleased to say bankers are now joining our advisory board and directors. We're getting first-class bank advice as we approach the next step, which is a business plan that a state regulator will look at and say, this bank's going to make it. Because no state regulator wants to give you a charter and watch you fail. It's a bad look.
It was a great day of meetings and input, and if people wanted to revisit it, they can see the videos, right? On
it'll be up, I guess, about 10 days' time.
Okay, at
www.publicbankingpa.org.
All right. Publicbankingpa.org. And for more information about, and if you'd like to visit the New Mexico conference, those videos are up, those presentations are up at bankingonnewmexico.org. Mike, thanks very much for joining us today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. That's Mike Krause from the Pennsylvania Project here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. For more information about public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, PRN.FM, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.